I think you wanted to say something.
Yes, sir. You know, computer microchips are in everything. They're in air conditioners, they're in stereos, vape receivers, refrigerators, and SDR radios. My question is, if we're served up superior microchips, microchips that blow away anything that we know, will that improve, specifically improve the quality of radios? And would it be a good idea to wait until that technology is widely in use? Go ahead.
Look, you can always wait for the next model of everything because 3G accelerators will get more powerful and processors will get more powerful and all these things, except for unfortunately batteries, will get more powerful or will get less expensive. So, you know, you decide if you want to wait. You could wait until 3 seconds before you shuffle off this mortal coil, and you'll get probably the best stuff, you know, unless some calamity strikes us before now and then. But ultimately, you make your own decisions of when to buy the stuff and play with it and enjoy what's available. Will it make the specs that much better? I personally don't think so. I think it will make the cases smaller. The radio cases will be smaller, lighter, less expensive, more efficient. I don't think the specifications per se will dramatically improve. The capability, the flexibility, the adjustability will improve. But, you know, the intermod distortion, I don't think you're going to find any real amazing difference because your processors are more powerful. It depends upon the technology you're even using. You can't just kind of basically say that this chip is 853 times faster. Usually these new chips are faster for some things, less faster for other things. They're optimized for different features. That's why some of the Flex radios use, rather than something like an Intel or the Apple RISC or microprocessor, they use something called a field programmable gate array, which is sort of able to software design the hardware configuration of the chip and to modify it, to optimize it for certain calculations, so that they run the calculations required for a software-defined radio at a faster rate than if they just swapped a very powerful RISC or Intel chip. So, you know, you can't kind of simplify it by saying this chip is 853 times faster than the fastest other chip. Electronics and computer science, unfortunately, doesn't work that way. But that's the best of my prediction, that SDRs will become ubiquitous. They will have a lower price point, more efficient design, smaller, lighter, and more features. You know, you'll have a whole bunch of extra tuners that will be able to operate simultaneously if you fill
repeater timeout. Repeater timeout canceled.
Okay, I think I just made that timeout.
No problem, sir. I guess, you know, with SDR radios, I gotta go to the store and listen to them. Listen to one right after the other. The radio speaker and then the external speaker, see what they sound like, you know? Otherwise, you know, I have no idea, and I'm sure one versus another, it's probably not that different. But I'm just wondering if a much more capable microchip was powering a radio, whether it would make a difference.
Again, I don't really see how that would happen. You might have a wider bandwidth available. You might be able to operate on multiple bands receiver-wise simultaneously. The feature set would widen, but a particular transmission is not going to be that much different whether you have a high-end SDR with an extremely powerful field programmable gate array or you have a lesser-powered Intel-based software-defined radio. Just have less virtual receivers, you have a narrower total received bandwidth, it kind of limits the scope, but on the individual conversation, I doubt you'll be able to perceive a difference. You'll be able to test out, theoretically, if they're set up to do that, the Japanese SDRs. American SDRs, as far as I'm aware, aren't really usually sold in these retail outlets, so it'll be more problematic to test drive them. But I'm sure you could talk people into letting you come by their shack and listen to their SDR radios. You know, every third person, it seems, has a 7300. That's an SDR. Yaesu has new radios that are SDRs. It's going to be more so as time goes on. Eventually, there's going to be a point, I perceive, that it's going to be difficult to get an actual analog modern radio. It'll just all move to radios on chips.
K2FIU?
Yes, George.
Roy, I agree. I agree that we are going to be moving toward SDR radios. Actually, for the manufacturing capability of making it less expensive. It's proven all along as we go through higher levels of technology, there are more features available and it's less expensive. Well, except for home appliances. our stoves and our refrigerators and things like that. And we don't need high capacity programming chips to do those kind of things. Hopefully we don't, because I don't see my stove being the size of my coffee pot doing the same thing. But I agree that we are going to be seeing more SDR radios coming through simply because they're going to be easier to make. Not necessarily more user the user will not have the ability to repair it. It's like the cheap HT that comes our way. I got my HT for $45, but didn't work. Well, I'm not getting it fixed. I'm throwing it out, and I'm going to get the $25 HT. Over to you, Roy. KD2FIU.
I don't know what to tell you. Welcome to the disposable economy. This is our present, not only our future, but this is our present. Surface mount has allowed manufacturing to be automated, keeping labor costs down and making repair costs enormous. To the point where, you know, if you ever have a broken television, I once had my TV that broke under warranty. They come by, they pop out the back, they pull out a whole circuit board, put in a new circuit board, and go on their merry way. With never the idea of fixing that circuit board. That thing probably gets put in a landfill. So that's going to be our future. It already is with consumer goods, the iPhones, the iPads, all these things. I mean, recently I mentioned that I popped the front and swapped the battery. A lot of people wouldn't even bother to do that. If the battery's not working, throw it away and get a new $1,000 iPhone. God bless America. What can I tell you? That's the future we're all looking at. Gone will be the days where you pop the lid off of your radio and put a couple of capacitors replacements and get back to business. Anything goes wrong, and you pop it in the garbage, and you get yourself a brand new shiny one that's capable of three more things at 5% less.
Quick comment.
Finally.
Thank you, Roy. This is Jeff AC2PL. I don't know if there was a degree of sarcasm, not in your comments, Roy. Your comments were very, very clear. At the previous station suggested that why would you need such a thing? Why would you need such a thing? Well, it doesn't really matter whether we need certain things. Certain things are granted to us as rights by our Constitution, and we will have those things one way or the other. Thank you very much. AC2PL. KG2RY.
Yes.
David?
My response is that you got to know what you want, and if you don't know what you want, you can't get what you want. And if you know what you don't want, then you can also get what you want. I was just going to say that they were talking about importing computer microchips, mostly from Taiwan. We have a situation where China wants to take over Taiwan. So the United States decides they're going to make their own microchips much faster, much better. And I guess, you know, maybe if you can find the 7300 that you can buy now, you know, I don't think it's so easy. And, yeah, you know, one microchip versus another one. But I think a faster microchip and a more advanced circuitry, it certainly should, certainly could improve the quality of the radio.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George.
Did I say the word need?
Yes, you did.
Okay, I'm sorry if I... there's a misunderstanding there. Maybe want?
Want is fine. Need is a different thing.
Okay. When I want, it's because I personally need.
That too, is just fun.
There you go. All right. So I want to clarify to put us back on the right track over here. You understand what I'm saying now?
With that clarification, absolutely.
Don't obsess, though.
It's not a matter of obsession.
No.
Okay, everyone, calm down. We have peace. Let's continue with peace. Okay, I just want to touch base on... David did mention something of interest to me. Semiconductors, I've been watching those since Zilog and all those lovely people back in Texas Instruments days. TSMC is a major semiconductor foundry in Taiwan. They have pumped billions of dollars into R&D and in manufacturing facilities. High-end foundries are ridiculously expensive, incredibly unique. There's only a few companies that build them. There's only a few companies that can afford to have them built. And they right now are the kind of king of high-end, high-density, high-speed, high-capacity semiconductors. There are other foundries in the world, Korea, Samsung, is doing very good things with memory chips, but really, unfortunately, Taiwan is the place to go for the time being. And during this COVID problem, a lot of people miscalculated the amount of chips that they would indeed and let their placing line slip, and then when they went to retrieve it, we're told that someone else took their placing line. And so right now we need the boundaries to be built, but it takes a finite amount of time, billions of dollars, vast resources, a lot of pure water is needed. They go through a heck of a lot of water in those factories in Taiwan. So a lot of countries are going to be scrambling to build their own next-level foundries. The United States has invested billions of dollars, but it's going to take time. You can't build these things in a day and a half. So we're in a tough situation, but I think ultimately, if anything, there will end up being a glut of semiconductors. Memory prices will actually dip, and it'll correct itself one way or the other. But it's sort of true. Semiconductor design is very esoteric and ridiculously expensive. Although it still continues, they're doing very novel things. They're building semiconductors on their sides. They're building them up in three-dimensional space. They're doing all kinds of fascinating ways to get around the limitations. You can only clock to a certain rate unless you change the whole medium, which will cost billions if not trillions of dollars once someone figures out what the other medium should be. You know, maybe diamonds. Who knows?
Well, you know, I've been reading a lot about this. I know you have some very good information. But to say, they were talking about some company in the United States is building a supercomputer microchip, and they want to move all of the production in.
Well, I don't exactly know what a supercomputer microchip is. Most supercomputers these days are kind of built together of modules, and a lot of different modules plugged into each other. And then there's quantum computers that work on a completely different basis of quantum entanglement and cryogenics. But most supercomputers I'm aware of these days is not a single chip device. They are a multi-board device with a teraflop of basically modified graphic engines that run ridiculous amounts of floating point operations.
Well, you know, present day Apple computers, they have these things called M1 processors. M1 processor is a bunch of core processors put together into one, like case, like one chip or one how to say, you know, like one device. And it looks really good, and it takes up very little space. And they are faster, although I don't know how much faster. I was looking at the website that Steve Jobs had a prophecy before he passed away, and it was to create $10 trillion of investment opportunity. So Apple, you know, still up there.
KD2FRU question?
Yes, George.
I maybe misunderstood this term. What does exploding point mean?
Did anyone use that term? I was unaware of anyone using that term.
He said exploding point operation.
Okay, I meant floating point operation.
Not you, the other station.
Oh, okay.
I was talking about Apple.
Okay, M1 is a very nice design, and by the way, there is already an M2, just to annoy people who have M1. So they're going to feel as though they were cheated once again by Apple. Almost every central processing, micro central processing unit is a multi-CPU design. It has multiple cores. It has multiple real cores, and the cores can operate as a virtual core in addition. So, you know, my the CPU in my Shack's computer is capable of 16 real cores and 16 virtual cores. So having more cores is not a novel idea. What's somewhat novel these days is to have more efficient a set of low-power cores and less efficient high-power cores, and having the intelligence to shift from the core that serves the purpose for whatever algorithm you're operating in. So the designs will get more obscure and more fascinating and hopefully allow us to do more things, but we're kind of approaching Moore's Law's limits. There's only so much more you can squeeze out of a rock. So I wouldn't expect the same doubling as you've seen in the past. It's going to kind of slow down. And people are still, as I mentioned before, they're playing around with different mediums entirely. If you can figure out a semiconductor technology based on synthetic diamonds, that might have a lot of pluses in it that not really foreseeable with the silicon base. But again, it's going to cost trillions of dollars to do that.
Roy, the reason why clock speed has gotten basically to its limit around 4.0 gigahertz, they start building cores because they can't easily increase the clock speed of the processor with high-speed microcomputer chips. Could that also change?
Not under the present conditions, the materials that we use, the silicon, or all the technology we are aware of. We hit that time boundary something like 20 years ago. You know, I remember when people were talking about going beyond 5 gigahertz, and they realized that you would need a cryogenic station to maintain it. What happens is as you increase the clock rate on the present technology, the CPU heats up and starts to melt. So you need to put in a lot of cryogenics, and even then there's still a limitation. So I don't see in the foreseeable future getting through the limitations of processor speed. What's going to happen is there'll be more cores and much more sophisticated manipulation of the multiple cores in order to accomplish somewhat similar things that a higher clock speed could accomplish if the laws of physics could only be tweaked.
KD2FIU?
EF2P, Ed, with a comment.
Yes, Ed first, said George.
Another factor which we tend to forget is the speed of light. The physical distance between pieces of equipment becomes a factor. We can only get them physically so small. That's why they want to get down to the size of an atom, you know, if at all possible, so the distances can be shrunk. But it turns out you can only go so fast because of the speed of light. Electrical impulses to travel any distance. We're talking nanometers. We're talking very, very small distances. It's now a limitation.
Yes, I agree entirely with you. One of the basic, but the problem with that is that there's, as far as I know, there's no solution. Einstein's theory of relativity. You can't go faster than the speed of light. Now, how entangled particles work, they seem to kind of disobey the laws of locality and seem to kind of skirt the laws of relativity, but I don't think that that's going to be a solution. So, yeah, that's going to be something that people are just going to have to deal with. I don't think there's any way of getting around that particular problem.
KD2WOT.
Yes, Chris.
Yeah, well, just a comment. So, yeah, I mean, the speed of light naturally is a limitation. So the solution to that is the circuit density, which, you know, keeps getting closer and closer. So, you know, currently 7 nanometer, you know, they're trying to get to 5 nanometer. And there's a company, ASML, which is a company that produces the photolithographic equipment to etch the silicon. And they're working with wavelengths of UV light that, you know, are small enough to produce 5 nanometer at some point.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of work in shrinking the dye. You always hear about the size of each element. Now, unfortunately, they have shifted the definition so that when they say 4 nanometers, they don't really mean 4 nanometers. If you do a lot of Google searching, you can see that tends to be a kind of euphemism for reality. So it's not quite as good as it seems. They're putting things on their sides and playing around with definitions and such. But they are trying to shrink things. The problem is that if you make semiconductor elements too small, eventually the electrons will just leak right out of them and not give you anything that's viable. So again, unless you change the materials themselves, there's an inherent limitation in the size of each semiconductor element. You can't have, presently the way we work semiconductors, you cannot have a semiconductor that is a single atom or even a single molecule. I mean, who knows? Maybe someone will discover it, but then again, you're stuck kind of reinventing the wheel, only if the wheel costs you $1 trillion.
True, but the current limitation, you know, has to do with the optics and the wavelength of the UV light that's being used to etch the silicon.
Yeah, and it seems to be a inherent limitation because they've just kind of been playing tricks with UV light to kind of get narrower and narrower things because they can't generate anything with a shorter wavelength than UV light at this point. So, again, we're kind of hitting a lot of unfortunate limits here. As long as we keep to the same substrates and the same general theories that have benefited us all these years, we're going to just creep up onto a boundary point where you can't really go much better than we are. Again, we can build things on their sides, we can build things in 3D and stack them up, as far as putting them closer together and shrinking them down smaller, we're getting to a precarious position where laws of physics aren't our friends.
Absolutely. And then, of course, it becomes heat dissipation. So there's definitely limitations. You know, they haven't been hit yet, but, you know, we're certainly closer and closer.
Yeah, there was a problem about 8 months or 9 months ago. Intel kind of showed off, hey, look at us, high-end chip that just was basic chip that tested better than almost any other, and then hit the fact that they had a cryogenic freezer unit as the heat sink in order to keep it from melting itself. So, you know, it's big business, commercial. I understand Intel is at a never-ending fight with AMD, and now Apple has joined the group with the M2 chip, which will eventually be an M3 and an M4 and an M5 and an M6. So, you know, it's nice to know that innovation continues. So, David, do you want to give our final comment before we close this segment of the Technical Met tonight?
Sure. Thank you very much, Roy. You know, for Apple, supposedly they're are going to make an announcement the next few days, specifically about something that will replace all smartphones, computers, and the way that we live will change. But for some reason, when I look to see what this product is, so there is no information about it. Thank you very much, Roy.
Okay, very good, David. I don't know. I usually think that I keep up to date, and I have no knowledge of this. And I would be incredibly surprised if that happened. But who knows? Anyway, thanks to everyone who participated tonight. We had some lively discussion. I'm sorry that we couldn't get to Taylor. I hope he'll be back next Sunday night. And if he is, I'll put him on the top of the list because he missed out this time. So thanks to everyone, and I'll be back at the close. But until then, call WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
Thanks, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N, and this is Paul with the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And, okay, well, we're going to cover just really two main topics I wanted to get to is the Capstone mission and, of course, the James Webb Space Telescope mission. That will be the big news during the week, I'm sure. But Capstone is a mission that was launched on July 4th and successfully launched out of New Zealand by Rocket Lab. The owner is Peter Beck, and he's been launching quite a few of these Electron rockets. They flew, this is probably around his 26th or 27th flight, and he's doing quite well. They're getting to the point where they're going to have reusable boosters. But anyway, the contract was with NASA to launch Capstone, and it got off successfully. And July 4th, it orbited Earth. It's going to orbit Earth around six times each time, getting more and more elongated. And then by the final push, each time it goes around, it fires its engine. And then the final push pushes it toward the moon. The idea is to go into a lunar near rectilinear halo orbit. That's the goal. They're NASA setting this up. They want to see if this orbit is stable, because eventually we're going to have the Gateway space station, which is NASA's really big investment in space stations. No longer the ISS. They're interested in Gateway. But they need to make sure that orbit's going to be stable. So the first rocket they launch is a test rocket with this 50-pound spacecraft called Capstone. And the final push, everything was looking great. And then they lost contact with it. Gone. Nothing heard from it for two solid days, almost 2 days. Capstone was lost communications. Mission control for Capstone is located in Colorado, West Minnesota, Colorado. And they had lost complete control. Not only control, but the no communication whatsoever. Naturally, it seemed like a depressing end. But sure enough, after 2 days, the signal came back. So after going through the data and they get telemetry down, they finally figured out what went wrong with Capstone. That final push, right after that final push, they saw some irregularities in the trajectory, and they wanted to check things. So they sent up a signal to have the spacecraft give them information on what they thought might be wrong. but they actually sent with that signal another signal which actually shut down the radio. Now, the software on board the spacecraft was supposed to, if that ever happens, it's going to correct it and we'll bring the radio back on. But apparently the software, two things went wrong. So they sent up a signal they shouldn't have sent. And on top of that, the software wasn't set right to immediately bring the radio up. But also there's a timer on it. If a certain amount of time goes by, the computer on board the spacecraft will actually start to resend messages back to Earth and gain communications. And that's what it did, but it took a couple of days. Naturally, they're very happy about this. And it worked autonomously. I mean, it, even when it was off, it was doing slight attitude movements that it had to do. It itself knows where it's located in space. It has reaction wheels. It's moving, moving one way or the other. And they actually got to the point where the reaction wheels, on reaction wheels, when they operate too much, they need to reverse the spinning of the spacecraft itself. So they'll actually fire thrusters to move the spacecraft to reset the ability to reaction wheels to work. So it knew all this stuff. It did a couple of things like that, and also started sending signals back, reporting back to Earth. So actually, that's very happy. Once the thing goes into its orbit, stays there for at least 6 months. This was a planned mission, but it could stay there for years. It could stay there without any kind of thrusters, or very minimal amount of thrust will ever be needed to stay in that one location, which would be perfect for a space station. So they need to know that will work. They also have a system on board where they're going to transmit to an existing spacecraft that's in orbit around the moon called the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. That's been up there since 2009. And they want to be able to send signals to it and use the frequencies, speed of light and all this. They'll know exactly how far they are from that spacecraft and in turn be able to report that information back to Earth. But they'll have a new way of navigating the exact location of where something in this particular orbit is going to be. They'll have GPS out there, so this is what they plan on doing. One of the systems that they plan on using. This way, when we have people up there in a space station, they'll know exact locations to, within a centimeter, probably. So, when they had lost the signal for a day or two, Peter Beck said, well, the kick stage that we use is actually its own spacecraft. It's called a Photon. And, they were going to just let that go and not worry about it anymore after it did its job by putting Capstone into space. Turns out that he says, well, if Capstone doesn't come back to life, we'll use our spacecraft, and it could do some of the things that a Capstone will do. We'll let it go into that particular orbit. To get to that orbit, this is a very low price mission. It's like only a $15 million launch from New Zealand. Very inexpensive spacecraft. They didn't want to use a bigger rocket. They didn't want to use a lot of fuel. They're using this system where the spacecraft just got to pass the moon. In fact, it's past the moon now. It's going to go around three times the distance of the moon. To a point where eventually it's going to come to a stop, and then actually start coming back toward the moon and Earth using the gravitation of like the sun and the Earth and the moon to actually pull it back. And when it comes back, they'll use a little thrust to fire on the spacecraft to put it into extreme elongated orbits. You know, it'll go over the South Pole for maybe 6 or 7 days, and eventually, when it starts coming back, it'll go over the North Pole for, you know, less than a day. So it'll spend most of its time over the South Pole, which is what they want, because eventually, the ultimate goal is, of NASA is to set up a base. And where they want to set it up, they want to set it up on the south, southern part of the moon. And years into the future, if they decide they want to, you know, keep operations on the northern part, they can actually change that orbit. You can actually put the space station where it hangs mostly on the northern part of the moon instead of the southern part. So they have that option in the future. So I thought that was pretty good. So we'll see how they do. We'll actually be into orbit in November. That's how long it's going to take to do this. And then from there, they'll start doing accurate measurements. They'll get results. I mean, it wouldn't have stopped the Gateway project, but they really want to have this this test spacecraft out there just to see how it does, how it handles staying in this really bizarre orbit. But the main story I wanted to get to is the James Webb Space Telescope. Before I do that, is there any questions or comments? Put in that WS tour. Okay, we're going to see the fun news on Tuesday. And if you're retired, if you happen to be home that day, they'll release the pictures, the very first pictures of the James Webb Space Telescope. They said 10:30 in the morning, so 10:30 a.m. on Tuesday. And they'll have it on all the social media sites, of course, but you could always get it on NASA TV, which I always bring up on my computer, and I'll have that live. And from what I understand, it's going to be at least 10 pictures that they're going to put out. So I'm looking forward to that. This is a $10 billion, probably over 20-year construction project. Where technicians have been working on this for decades. It's been thought about this bubble. So plenty of people that have started working with this, that some of them are still there and some of them have retired. The $10 billion project, I believe, and from what I heard, is pictures are going to be phenomenal. And hopefully they team them up with pictures of things from the Hubble Space Telescope. You know, this way we can have AV pictures with the difference. But they plan on releasing some information, like the Carina Nebula. This is almost 8,000 light years away. Showing those pictures, you'll be able to see through the dust and clouds that are around stars that are forming. You'll be able to see deep into that, where with all these other telescopes, you won't be able to do that. Plus, with a 21-foot mirror, a little over 21-foot diameter mirror, compared to Hubble's 8-foot mirror, it's going to be a big difference. Hubble was launched in 1990. It didn't get it really operating until 1993 with all the problems they had. This one had no problem. It went up a little over 6 months ago, actually the morning of Christmas Eve, and it spent the first a little over a month traveling out to the present location, which is L2, Lagrange Point 2. Sun, Earth, spacecraft. They stay in line like that forever. They all travel. They both travel around the sun together. So that took a month, and then calibrating everything. The mirrors, each mirror is roughly about a meter wide. And little hexagonal shape, and they have the ability to move it, you know, less than a distance of a hair. They can move one way or the other, all those different individual pieces, and that's a, you know, solar, you know, probably 4 or 5 months. And then they have 4 detectors on board, different types of instruments that will be able to look at the universe, mostly, of course, in infrared and then far infrared as well. Far infrared one, they call it MIRI. That one needs to get down to 7 degrees Kelvin. The other ones could work, you know, 40 degrees or so Kelvin in the other three instruments, but MIRI needs to be even colder. So they actually have a cascade refrigeration unit on board. So, you know, you have really it's like 3 refrigeration units in one, you know, each one getting colder and colder and colder. They're able to get the 40 degree Kelvin temperature down to 7 degrees. So it's like 7 degrees absolute temperature, you know, above absolute zero. And they've done that, and the block is a copper block that actually gets down to that temperature. So they've been cooling it for quite a while, and that all works good. And whenever they need to, they'll turn that on to bring it down to an even colder temperature. So I'm looking forward to seeing these pictures. They have a coronagraph on board where, you know, you can actually black out the sun. Will they be able to see maybe a planet or some, you know, something close to something that might look like a planet? Who knows? They have something called WASP-98b, whatever that is. They want to look at it. It's a giant planet outside of our solar system that they would like to look at. Southern Ring Nebula. A couple of other things, massive galaxies, and they have a list of 4 or 5 different items that they put out, and there'll be more because I think there's going to be 10 pictures. But anyway, this should be on Tuesday morning, 10:30, and of course, if you don't see it, they'll have all the information, all the pictures, you know, for forever on their website. You know, I always go to NASA.gov, and then, you know, you can always find out the latest information. But they'll store those pictures on there till the end of time, I'm sure. Any questions or comments? WS2N. Okay, I came across this one article. I'm not sure if this is how believable this is, but I mean, there's a bunch of physicists now claiming that it's possible that dark matter theory does not exist, or that it's wrong, let me put it that way. You know, they're basing it on the information from physicists from years ago, from the 1970s, the guy came out of Israel, and led Milgram, anyway, in 1982, it says that he came up with the theory that, you know, on the outer edges of all these galaxies, that gravity somehow changes. Gets weaker and weaker, and his theory is that there was no dark matter there pulling the stars around. You know, years ago they were looking at galaxies. One woman, astronomer, Vera Rubin, she's looking at these stars going around galaxies. notice that on the outer ones, they're moving relatively fast. They should be moving slower because they're further away from the main mass of the center of the galaxy. And ever since then, they looked into it, and somebody eventually coined the phrase dark matter, and they've been running with that ever since. But apparently, this one guy thinks that somehow the gravity on the outside of the, the very outside, it actually changes from the Newtonian system of gravity to something else. So if anybody ever comes across this, this theory is called MOND, M-O-N-D. Put in M-O-N-D, gravity, and get all kinds of information about this. But this is more of a talking point. Frankly, I believe in dark matter, and but maybe, who knows, you never know. Somewhere down the road, somebody will say something like this, and you find out maybe it's true. But there's no evidence. Just a story that came out on the physics.org website. So, any comments? WS.
Yeah.
Was that you, Roy? I think it was the double.
Okay, if someone else wants to comment, feel free, I'll go second.
KG2RY. I have a question, I don't have a comment.
Oh, okay, Dave. Go ahead.
Could you tell me about very low Earth orbit satellites and the whole internet and cable TV transmission?
Okay, well, yeah, we've been doing it since Telstar, 1952. And they haven't stopped. But now, of course, it's getting out of hand. Elon Musk putting thousands of satellites up there. I think he's close to having 3,000 Starlink satellites up there. You have OneWeb, another company. He's already got, I think, 450 satellites up there. He's shooting for around 650, I think. And then you have Amazon. They're willing to do the same thing. And pretty much low Earth orbit. You know, the space station is at 250 miles above the surface of the Earth. Elon Musk's satellites are around 350. Then he's going to have another group a little higher than that. OneWeb is going to be around 600 miles above the Earth. And all these multiple constellation satellites, not only, different layers, different heights, different, they have different inclinations. Like Musk is the first, like 800 or so were all in, 53 degree inclination of the Earth, which is the highest above the Earth, above the equator it goes 53 degrees, and below is 53 degrees. So since most of the population on the Earth resides, roughly from the equator north and south to around 50 degrees, his first 1,000 or so satellites should have enough to have people sign up with them, start paying them money for Starlink, which he's done. Right now there's, I just read it last week, he's got 400,000 customers, which sounds like a lot, but he wants to have not millions, but eventually billions signed up paying him monthly fees. Right now the prices, I think, are pretty high. Pushing around $450 for an antenna receiving unit. And he started out with $99 for a month for the service, but now they're up to $149 a month. So that's getting expensive. He needs to be able to get that lower, keep it below, let's say, Cablevision or, you know, Verizon. You know, you got to compete with those people. Telephone service, you know, for instance, with Cablevision, you could have cordless phone and, or, you know, landline phones, which I have, which I, you know, I love. Would never want to give that up. Most people, they have cell phones, but I'm not crazy about having just a cell phone. I like a landline. Naturally, Elon Musk won't be able to do that. You could have voice over IP, but I mean, what do you do? Give your doctor some kind of website or something to get your, to bring your phone at home. You have to have your computer on, and you know, that's a bargain. It's better to have a wireless, a wired system, I believe. So Elon Musk is going to have two main things, computer and TV. You know, sure, he'll be able to transmit 4K or maybe even 8K now. But to me, he's missing one of the most important things, which is communication. And as a ham, I believe in, communication. And, you know, I mean, we spent thousands of dollars on these radios and all these equipment, joining clubs and everything. And the cell phones and things, that's secondary. Important. All these things are important to have communications. Just have TV and computer, emailing people through your computer, send messages through your computer. I'm sure there's ways around it, but I don't know, it's not like having a cell phone. It's very important. And whatever Dave was talking about before, whatever you was talking about, but it's going to replace all this. I don't know. I haven't seen anything about that yet either. We'll wait and see. Over to you, Dave. I mean, we can go on with geosynchronous satellites too, but I mean, that's, I think, what you're getting at. Back to you, Dave.
QSL, Paul. I think ham radio is everything, you know. I think that with more of these sophisticated technologies, so-called communication technologies, you know, it'll bring people more and more back to ham radio, and we'll get more and more involved, and it'll become much more popular. You know, when I walk down the street with an HT, people smile at me. People like to ask me, what is that? You know, and what is an HT? You know, from here to the repeater. And it's quite fantastic, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure you've demonstrated it. It's a, you get some strange answers and questions, and you got to be kidding, remarks. I remember coming back in the, it had to be in the 1980s, and we were carpooling from deep inside of Queens coming out to Suffolk County. We got caught in a snowstorm, one of these deals where you didn't know, you thought you were going to have an inch of snow, and next thing you know, you got 8 inches of snow. And we're riding in a car, and not going very far. We're spending hours and hours in the car. So I pulled out the HD, and we had phone patch was popular back then. So I said, "Well, I'm going to call home." I went through the phone patch system. You know, my wife grabs the phone. Okay, we're in the middle of a snowstorm. You know, won't be home for many, many hours. And the guy I'm with, he was driving. He said, "That is great. Can you call anybody?" I said, "Yeah, we'll call your old wife." And he was old timey, he was
that time. Completely.
He thought this was the greatest thing. Anyway, you demonstrate this stuff and you really get converts. Back to you, Dave.
Q QSL, Paul. Well, I remember the day back in like 1975 when I got my radio telephone license. I had a friend, his name was Stan, and he had WA2 call sign, and I was stuck with WB2 at that time. And he had a 2 meter HT with a touch tone pad. And he said, you know, we can call anybody on the telephone through the repeater for 25 cents a call.
Okay, very good, Dave. Very good. Well, yeah. And different demonstrations.